time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Trevor Griffey and Sydney Gillis. Trevor Griffey is the publisher and founder of the Olympia Newswire. He has been a contributing writer for Real Change, the South Seattle Star, Colors Northwest, and the Seattle Weekly. He is also the co-founder and project coordinator for the Seattle Civil Rights and Labor History Project. Sydney Gillis is a reporter with Real Change. She has more than two decades' experience in community journalism, covering business and the arts at regional weekly and daily newspapers in the Seattle area since 1987. Trevor and Sydney, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Start out and tell us, what is the Olympia Newswire?
Well, the Olympia Newswire is a new nonprofit independent source of news that has a pilot project going right now that is focusing on the state legislature, the state legislative session in Olympia, the 60-day session. We started with in an unusual way, in that we started with a kind of challenge grant and a community-based fundraising drive that took place during the last 2 weeks of December and the first week of January, so in the very lead up to the legislative session, at the very last minute, based on the intense budget cuts that had happened in 2009 and a sense of crisis about the dwindling number of reporters in Olympia, a community came together here in Seattle to do fundraising to hire journalists to cover basic issues that we felt deserved greater attention than they were likely to get otherwise. And so, starting on a shoestring budget out of this community-supported work, we've been able to hire three different reporting kind of, how to put it, I was going to say three different reporters, but we have three different areas that we do reporting on. One is the economy, taxes and the budget. The other is education. And the third is social services. And Sid comes from Real Change, who we've subcontracted to do our social services reporting.
All right, and who is your primary audience? Is it via the internet? Does your stuff get picked up by any other news services?
We started with the plan of syndicating our work, and some of the legal complications involved in that have slowed us down. But in the meantime, it's important to note that we do have fiscal sponsorship from Real Change, and that a number of our stories are syndicated in their print publication, which has about a circulation of about 18,000. But the main portal for viewing all our content is at www.olympianews.org.
Very good. And can people who are listening contribute to the Newswire?
Absolutely. And actually, this is one aspect of the Olympia Newswire, where our intervention, and we can talk about this more sort of towards the end of our discussion, but one aspect of the Newswire model is that the for-profit model for journalism needs to be rethought. We are a nonprofit, and rather than going for subscribers or going for online ad revenue, we think that an important part of the way of the future is to create a kind of community of support that is going to provide fundraising at the back end to make sure that public interest journalism and investigative journalism gets the funding it deserves to sustain itself, and that it shouldn't be held captive to insane profit margins in terms of the kinds of expectations that people have of it, because it's a time-consuming process. And so there are ways to donate to the Newswire to keep our pilot project going. You can donate online, or you can make a check out to Olympia Newswire, care of Real Change, 2129 2nd Avenue, Seattle, 98121.
Very good. So give us an overview of the current legislative session. We're halfway through with it at this point in time?
Yes, that's correct. This is a short legislative session. So basically, Washington has what's called a citizen legislature, which is to say that rather than having full-time state legislators creating laws all year round, we have a legislature that every odd year is in session for 4 months and kind of structures what's called the biennium budget, the two-year budget, and passes a number of laws and can go into greater detail on a number of issues. And then on even years, which are the election years, and this year being a midterm election, we have short sessions that are kind of in the middle of the biennium where they tweak what was done before and perhaps add new issues to their plate, but have much less time to do so. So we're about 30 days in, and we have about 30 days left, and things have become very charged because of the economic crisis. Last year, immediately following Obama's election and these promises of change, the state, because of the economic recession, had a $9 billion budget shortfall, and it closed the vast majority of that through a combination of furloughs and service cuts because of a wariness of raising revenue, of reforming our tax structure. And by raising revenue, that's a kind of code word now for raising taxes that includes closing tax loopholes as well as raising new taxes. And the cuts in some cases were extreme. And we had an additional 2.6, it's now up to $2.8 billion budget deficit that the legislature had 60 days to deal with this legislative session. And with so many social service, education, environmental issues being affected by the budget cuts last year, civil society groups have really stepped up. But on the other hand, we see a growing kind of anti-tax politics taking hold at the national level, where Republicans sort of sense an opportunity for change this year, and there's a great deal of uncertainty about what's going to happen. And basically, in the legislative session so far, up until about a week and a half ago, most of the talk about how to close the budget was fairly abstract, and it's only been in the past week and a half that we've really seen concrete proposals to close corporate tax loopholes, to increase taxes, as well as to move legislation that had been discussed in hearings out of committee and onto the full floor for votes. And that's part of why we brought Sid on the show today, was so that she could talk in detail about some of the issues that she's been reporting on, and about how the budget crisis is partly affecting social services. And by social services, we've meant health care. And very few people, or at least not enough people, I would say, know that Washington State actually has a public option already, that all the debates about whether to do a public option and the thoughts about it being untested at the national level they interestingly overlook any number of state projects, including here in Washington, where the waiting list is actually greater than the number of people served, but where the program itself has successfully provided health insurance to low-income people who otherwise wouldn't have had it. We also have income supports for disabled people of different kinds who are unable to work, and any number of social service programs where those who are most vulnerable to the loss of services will feel the budget cuts perhaps the most. And Sid and the other reporters at Real Change have been doing a great job in kind of trying to keep tabs on these issues, so that rather than following what politicians say, we actually follow what they do. And hopefully that can inform any number of debates, whether it's about raising revenue or about the midterm elections.
So, Sid, maybe you can fill us in on, you've been writing about this, you've been writing about these issues for a long time, but what have you seen that in the current legislative session that has been both hopeful and depressing?
Well, at the midterm here, it's somewhat depressing because some of the bills that folks were hoping for in terms of foreclosure forbearance or forcing banks to provide homeowners who are facing foreclosure with like a mediation session where they might be offered mitigation on their loan, some of those bills have gone to the wayside given the pressure of the banking industry, and that's been a disappointment. One success that we have had just yesterday was that a bill put forward by Seattle Representative Mary Lou Dickerson to rescue and reform this program that Trevor mentioned, that is a disability program for the poor, 40% of whom in King County are homeless. It's called, it has this terrible name, and this is one of the things Mary Lou Dickerson is trying to fix. It's called General Assistance Unemployable, which is social service wonks call that, GAU. And it is a program that for folks who have been temporarily thrown out of work or in many cases are homeless and have actually been disabled for some time and really unable to do anything about a mental problem or a physical problem. It provides them with $339 a month, which is next to nothing, to get by, and then medical benefits. What Mary Lou's bill would do, which passed yesterday on the floor of the House, would change the name of that so people, in part, her idea was if people understood what it was, they might be willing to, raise taxes when the ask comes for something called the Disability Lifeline. So that's part of the bill. Another part would be that it would try to expedite the Department of Health and the Department of Social and Health Services getting people from this state program into a queue where they apply for federal benefits, Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, which is a federal disability program for the poor. And when they are accepted by SSI, the state gets paid back. So what Mary Lou is trying to do is expedite the situation in which the feds pay us back for someone who the state has paid out money to help them with the $339 a month grant and the medical coverage and get that person moved on to federal benefits and Medicaid. The state pays for this medical coverage up to that point, by the way. Get them on Medicaid and double what they get every month so they can actually maybe move on and have a chance of getting some stable housing or getting some of the services they need.
And it's worth noting, one of the significant parts of this bill just passing the House yesterday and also of our covering it more generally is that this is the second year in a row in which Governor Christine Gregoire has proposed eliminating this program entirely. And it's one of those classic contradictions that comes up during a moment of budget crisis when the state is flush, it seems that the cost of providing a social safety net is much lower, right? Because the economy is doing well, you can add taxes, and people don't feel the pinch as much. But when revenues start to decline for state or federal government, some of the programs that are least popular because they serve the most neediest, those who are most vulnerable, and those who often they're not very politically powerful. And their programs sometimes come up as this question of, well, you know, we could afford it once, but we can't now. Whereas for many of the people receiving these benefits, it's a question of survival rather than a question of luxury. And it's not one that actually changes a great deal between recessions and boom times. And that's just one of the many ways in which we actually see some contention within the Democratic Party over how far to go in terms of supporting these kinds of programs during a recession.
One of the problems, though, is that GAU, hopefully to be known as Disability Lifeline in the future, it's only state-paid, and that is why it is so expendable. It doesn't get any federal matching dollars. I mean, once the person gets onto Medicaid in that queue to get federal benefits, there will be matching funds for the Medicaid coverage. But this money is all coming from the state, and so it always ends up on this list of things to be cut because you've got to be willing to do something like raising revenue this time out to save it, and that's sort of where a lot of these discussions lie. Basic health, the basic health plan, which Trevor also mentioned, is very similar. This past legislative session, 35,000 people were already cut from the rolls of the basic health plan, which is essentially a state sponsored health coverage for the working poor. And this year they are now looking at, as a result of the governor's original budget, looking at cutting the rest of the 65,000 people on the plan, which you think, well, too bad, maybe we can't afford that. That's a luxury, but that system supports an entire community clinic network system that would be devastated to lose the payments of that health coverage. So it just would make everyone's life more difficult for those who already don't have coverage seeking health care from a community clinic.
And there's actually there's a reason why some of these social safety net programs are embedded within state government rather than federal government. To some degree, ever since the 1980s, the federal government has been devolving programs. It's not to say that it's still not an important player in providing social services, but the commitment by the federal government to any number of forms of income support and health care and other programs.
Mental health care in particular?
Yeah, exactly. That the most vulnerable in our society have come to depend on, especially as the middle class has shrunk and unemployment has grown. Those programs have been devolved to the states, but without the federal government providing the kind of support that the states were able to sustain them. And so that has been difficult, especially over time, as the cost of healthcare in particular has grown. But it means that this is a bit of a question of values, where we're getting to a point where we have no other place to devolve these programs to. You can't keep bucking responsibility, and we're reaching a point right now with some of these state services where if we don't get more federal support, and if we don't find ways to support them at the state level, they're in danger of disappearing entirely. Now, to some degree, the governor put forward a budget to balance the budget at the, before the legislature began, because she's constitutionally required to propose a balanced budget, and this one in particular, when she issued it, she said, "I don't even believe in my own budget." But when the time came for her to issue a revised budget, where she said, "Okay, well, here's the moment for you to say what you believe in," she listed a number of programs she wanted to, quote-unquote, buy back, which meant these are the programs she'd like to see saved, and implicitly, this is the amount of money that she would like to see the legislature raise. And she didn't give specifics, so that left it to the legislature to raise the taxes. And to a really important degree, she also depended upon the federal government. Our senators had placed some important amendments to the health care legislation in the Senate that had been pending that would have provided supports to basic health and perhaps also to GAU and a number of other programs, Medicare and Medicaid. And with the Senate health care bill now in doubt, or at least potentially suspended well beyond what the state can depend upon, even that punting to the federal government in this slapdash way that also the state had tried to do last year as well. And so what ended up actually happening last year was the state relied on the federal government to backfill a lot of its budget cuts to mitigate it. The stimulus money, rather than stimulating anything, simply was dwarfed by the size of state budget cuts across the country, and including here in Washington. But the stimulus money is not as available. The healthcare reform legislation doesn't provide as much. President Obama just recently issued a budget that has perhaps half the amount of money that they were hoping for in the Senate healthcare bill. And so now, again, the questions are, will we be able to afford it? And basic health is one of those things that is popular and that the Democrats' constituencies in particular is interested in seeing sustained. But there continues to be a real wariness of finding a sustainable financial basis through which to sustain them, and a continued hope that somehow the federal government is going to come in, or the economy is going to turn. And if they can just last this one more year and put off these decisions until it's a less hairy election year, then maybe they can kind of have their cake and eat it too.
I'll tell you what's depressing is hearing you talk about the health care reform bill in the Senate or otherwise as in the past tense.
Right. Well, I don't have any special knowledge on that. It's more just what's depressing is that the horizon for even passing anything is keeps moving into the future. And I think one thing that's important to remember with the healthcare legislation, while some in the Democratic Party base had hoped that this was an opportunity for social justice and have pushed for that and kind of social equality in our healthcare system, the primary motivation was that healthcare is probably one of the single biggest costs of providing services, government services of any kind, as well as certain kinds of private financial services, where we've seen the large big business outside of government, becoming more stingy on healthcare. But government, partly because the government unions, also partly because of a certain commitment, tends to provide more health care for its workers, but that's ballooned the cost of government and informs everything about the fact that we have this high deficit now. In addition to saving programs and the drop in revenue, people don't know. One of the things I've discovered as part of this, here's something you wouldn't know if you just relied on politicians for your news. The average number of state government workers per 1,000 residents of Washington has stayed relatively constant for the last 20 years. All this debate over the growing size of government, out of control government spending, basically between 16 and 17 state full-time employees per 1,000 residents of the population. So as population has increased, so has the size of, so has the number of employees. But the problem is that when their health care bills go up, all of a sudden the cost of government goes up well beyond what the revenue we have is to support them. And again, so many corporate tax loopholes have proved invulnerable to change, while the social program, the social safety net programs, and especially higher education and K-12 education have become the most vulnerable to being cut during this time.
So, Trevor, you and I were talking about this at one point. So what do the Republicans mean when they say that the Democrats spent us into the deficit we have now, given that per capita that you were just talking about?
Well, there's a lot of mystification going on with the budget is one of the things that we've stumbled upon, and that's not particularly surprising. I've thought of headlines that are like, you know, Democrats and Republicans using half-truths to talk about budget, and then I was like, is that a news item? I mean, to be honest, I think everybody in the general public expects that. They just don't know the details as much. But basically, the stakes of what's going on now, even though nobody's debating it like this, is that when we saw a recession, the last kind of significant recession, even though it wasn't as significant as the one we're in, came right after the dot-com bust and after September 11th. And Sydney was a business reporter and can talk in detail about like some of the things she saw on the business end of things here locally during that time. But that was also a time when Democrats and Republicans sort of had equal control and might have even had split governance in I believe, the state Senate. But the kind of gridlock in Olympia meant that the last time revenues seriously dropped, tax reform was completely off the table. Raising revenue was almost totally off the table. And social services were cut hard. And what we see now is really the question of, is that going to be our model again? As the economy has become even worse, is there another way? And that is what the Democrats are wrestling with. And the Democrats are not a monolithic party, but it's really important to note that they control over 60% of the seats in both the House and the Senate, and they have the governor's office. They are in complete control of what the state does right now. They can lock Democrats out entirely. And the debates that we're seeing over raising revenue are becoming fractious within the Democratic Party. And one of the stories that George Howland, former news editor at KCMU before it became KEXP, mm-hmm. founded the Strangers News Department before he went on to be news editor at the Seattle Weekly, he now writes for us on economy and budget issues. He'll be writing next week in some ways about this fractiousness and some of the innumerable caucuses that have developed and intrigue behind the scenes as Democrats are really saying, what do we stand for in this moment of recession?
I would be remiss, by the way, as the Real Change reporter, if I did not point out that when we talk about, first of all, when we talk about the tax increases, most of what we're discussing at this time are things like closing tax loopholes on companies, raising sin taxes again. There's a proposal on the table to put another dollar a pack on cigarettes. So we're not necessarily talking about gigantic tax increases on the population as a whole, but there is a proposal now afoot to raise the sales tax a penny, I believe.
Yes.
And the problem with the sales tax is that it is a regressive tax in the sense that more of a poor person's income goes to paying the sales tax than a wealthier person's income.
Yeah, and this is actually probably the biggest news in Olympia right now. After a month of speculation and after watching some of the Democrats' hopes for a federal bailout recede from possibility, we've seen a few bills introduced to close corporate tax loopholes that have actually quite predictably gotten some fairly fierce resistance. And this is something a lobbyist told me, and I think it's absolutely true. Every tax loophole has a mobilized constituency to defend it. Nobody is mobilized to oppose a sales tax increase. And it's partly because, and the only people who really seem to get up in arms and about it are progressives within the Democratic Party, or even sometimes to the left of the Democratic Party, who say that's regressive. But what's happened now is that because of a fear of tax reform, of having an income tax, and of closing corporate tax loopholes, that the path of least resistance in the short term, a group of liberals has decided, is to, in terms of raising a significant amount of revenue. There are lots of little revenue ideas, but the biggest one was just dropped as a bill, or introduced in common parlance on Thursday, was to increase the sales tax a penny. And there's legislation that already passed that would allow for residents, low-income residents, to basically get a tax credit at the end of the year. That liberal Democrats say, well, that offsets any regressiveness in the system. There's two potential problems with that. First is, will low-income people actually know that they can take this credit? And there's, the jury's still out on that. For a lot of people, the answer is no, but to my surprise, I've heard that similar programs based on the federal earned income tax credit and groups like the United Way actually have been able to help get the word out. I'm surprised by that, but
not enough people still take that tax credit. I want to point out
that's true. That's true. And the second is, for a party that is very worried about an anti-tax backlash, is the sales tax actually much worse than taking on corporate interests or taking on the wealthy, as would happen with an income tax, because it's something every single Washington resident would see every day that they buy something. And if that doesn't potentially increase a tax backlash against you, you know, I'm not sure what will. So it's definitely playing with fire.
I believe that an income tax bill has been introduced by Rosa Franklin from Tacoma, but yeah. I don't know if it's going to get any traction.
No, it won't. The short of it is it won't. But there is an initiative that's been introduced by a long-term opponent of Tim Iman named Noel Lowney, and it has a lot of people's attention, and it's got some people talking, and I'm not sure if the kind of mobilization that would be required would get behind it, but it's a high earners income tax that has been filed with the Secretary of State, and really the question, they're going to wait, the coalition of groups that could potentially push it is going to wait until the smoke clears to decide whether to move forward with it. But in the meantime, we have a tea party happening at 9 a.m. on this Monday, and then we have a big labor rally at noon. And
the revenue rally.
Exactly, and we will see... We will see both constituency groups out in force very soon.
So am I correct in taking from what you just said that the reason that the sales tax increase is even being proposed is because there wasn't the backbone to challenge the corporate loopholes?
Well, yes and no. It's a need for revenue, and that is independent of the tax loopholes, but the need for revenue becomes more urgent as some of these early attempts to address tax loopholes have gone through. And it should be said that some of these tax loopholes, actually, we call them loopholes, they're more like exemptions, and some of them make sense. And part of the problem is not only do we not tax personal income in the state, we don't tax corporate profits, we tax corporate revenues. And that actually puts a burden on small businesses, and some of those businesses actually benefit from exemptions, and it doesn't always make sense to end them. But the combined, it's really the fear of the income tax, fear of taxing corporate profits, and to some degree fear of closing those tax loopholes that has made liberal Democrats, who just simply want revenue rather than cuts, and who you'll hear say a raise in the income in the sales tax is less regressive than cutting benefits, is the kind of Orwellian line that we're hearing. Those are the folks who are pushing this now, mainly because they're not getting traction anywhere else.
We're talking with Trevor Griffey and Sydney Gillis, both with the Olympia Newswire. And tell us, how can people connect to and find out more about the Olympia Newswire?
Check us out at www.olympianews.org. If you support what we're doing, please donate, because nonprofit news requires donors on the back end who are invested in sustaining community and public interest journalism.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you both for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.